Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 8:58 p.m. and that is Pacific. So, sorry, no, it isn't. It is Central Time, and today is May 24th. Well, I drove from Tucson, Arizona, to Midland, Texas, yesterday, and then from Midland on to Dallas today, and moved into our new home, and our moving company will be arriving either tomorrow or the day after, but certainly getting internet connected tomorrow, and then hopefully I'll have my desk again on Wednesday. So when moving through Texas, there's certainly a number of things that are, I think, worth highlighting. Obviously, there's a massive change in topography between Arizona and New Mexico, and then into Dallas. Then, but I think the most important thing is the preponderance of wind turbines around Midland, in and then interspersed with the large number of oil rigs as well, and the I think rather busy environment, particularly on a Sunday, where there was a lot of service equipment getting moved around. And certainly, I think that there's plenty of activity that is still going on in the oil patch. It's not difficult to understand why, because the price of Brent crude is up to about $68. And then when we think about West Texas Intermediate, well, it's also trading in the region of about the $60 area, $66. And the majority of oil is economic from this area, around the $60 area. So that would suggest that there would be ample demand for workers, for services, for drilling rigs, and then we can think about the fact that oil prices remain quite firm. There's obviously the continued threat of unrest in the Middle East, although I really do think that this outbreak of hostilities between Gaza and Israel over the last couple of weeks has been more to do with Iran's efforts to negotiate with the West than any other factor or any other particular factor. Certainly, the timing of Iranian negotiations with the beginning of the hostilities is not a coincidence. When we then think about the oil services sector, well, it has been under the cosh, and there has been certainly a rather lengthy period of time where the price has been trending downwards, but it is beginning to steady, and we're starting to see support coming through in the region of the trend mean, and the last time we saw that was nearly 3 years ago. So certainly it's all to play for here, and we've had an really a very exaggerated decline. Then we can also think about the fact that wind turbines are perhaps the number one factor behind the continued outperformance of copper. So the wind ETF is right in the region of the trend mean. The solar ETF has pulled back more aggressively, and it is trading below its trend mean, but it is showing signs of steadying. There was a story over the weekend, I've got to post it in Comment of the Day today, where there was talk about the price of solar cells starting to increase, and they haven't increased in the last decade. And a lot of the utopian dreams of the solar sector are predicated on the continued downward path of the price of solar cells, and it's just not materializing. And a good reason for that is because of sand, and the cost of raw materials is going up, the cost of labor is going up. China was able to capture the lion's share of manufacturing for solar cells because they had lower costs, but commodity prices are rising, and commodity prices generally have been falling for most of the last decade, in line with the expectations then that solar panels would continually decline in price. The CRB index, and that is denominated in Australian dollars, let me put that into local currency. It's just broken its downtrend, but that downtrend lasted for 12 years. So we can then think about the this very rosy ideal that a lot of analysts had that solar panels would inexorably decline in price was very much tied to the fact that commodity prices would trend lower indefinitely, but that's just not the case. And as demand for all these renewables increases, well, then the ability of commodity producers to keep up with that demand is obviously starting to be questioned. And then, of course, they have had the visceral experience of going through more than a decade of underperformance of their products, so that there's a clear reluctance to invest a lot of money in additional new supply. And then, of course, we have the fact that the world is awash in money. So, on the one hand, we have supply inelasticity, because it's not easy to go out and build a world-class copper mine. It takes decades, and the copper price is in the region of its highs. You have the government of China talking about the fact that they're going to combat high commodity prices, but how on earth are they going to do that? Obviously, they're a major consumer, and it's something that they want to achieve, but the only way that they could possibly bring down the price would be to consume less or produce more of it themselves, and to pioneer new developments. And even then, the new developments take years to achieve. So it's likely to have a short-term impact on prices, but probably not much more than that. And the copper price has been ranging below the $4 area since 2006. So we're looking at a 20, excuse me, a 15-year range that has now been completed. So there's the potential here that we're looking at a new secular bull market in the copper price. And there's a great deal of copper goes into every wind turbine. And then, of course, there are the electric vehicle manufacturers. So Tesla's price has continued to steady in the region of the trend mean, and that is starting to look like some more definite evidence of support coming through now in the region of the lower side of this range that's been forming for the last few months. And every time Bitcoin, or I should say, every time Tesla starts to firm, it tends to have a positive effect on Bitcoin as well. So Bitcoin was up in a pretty impressive manner yesterday, and it was on, or I guess in here today, in my time zone, but the price for Bitcoin has already rolled over into tomorrow. And part of the reason for it was because Elon Musk was saying he's been talking with US based crypto miners. So the market is willing to latch on to any form of positive news. But I will say that the one thing that popped up to me in the drive over the last few days was a comment made on the Ryan Seacrest show in here this morning. And Ryan Seacrest is the host of American Idol, and his radio show tends to be full of fluff. But they were starting to give advice to people that they should go out and invest in cryptocurrencies and that it would change their lives. And to me, when one starts receiving investment advice from pop music radio pundits, then one has to think that there's a lot of interest already in the price, and how many people are out there that really haven't yet bought it. So we've had a significant decline. The price has halved. We're starting to see a little evidence of short-term support. The next big area of potential resistance is right where we are right now in the region of the trend mean, the 200-day moving average. But then, of course, the really big one is 50,000. That's the lower side of the overhead trading range. And in order to demonstrate that Bitcoin has done anything other than put in a short-term low, it will have to sustain a move above that level. And it's a much more risky asset now than it was in the run-up to the loss, or the beginning of the loss of consistency in mid-March. Asian markets have already opened, so the Australian market looks really quite similar to the pattern that we have on Wall Street, where we have a series of ranges, one above another, and mild consolidations, and the ASX is firming through the 7,000 level right now. I think we do or behoove us to go and look at more back history, because the price is firming around the 7,000 level, and that had been the terminal point of the big advance during the commodity bull market that peaked in 2007. So this is looking like another global index that is on the cusp of breaking on the upside. Then when we look at the Nikkei 225, it's also open right now, and it has rebounded again from the region of the trend mean. Now, obviously, this chart is showing us a lot more back history. It really helps to put the very lengthy base formation in context, but importantly here, it's bouncing from the trend mean, and this continues to look like a new secular bull market. And the Japanese market doesn't seem to be, or it's looking rather nonplussed at the rising number of cases in Japan and the potential threat that that represents to the Olympics. Then, when we think about what's going on in China, there's a war going on in most countries under the surface, and it's for the hearts and minds of the people. And it's really about how to improve living standards, enhance productivity, and to ensure that everyone has the ability to achieve their longer-term goals of a better standard of living. And globalization was largely parasitic on the Western world, and it allowed a lot of jobs to go overseas. Then we're at a point now where the technological advances that are being made in Asia are coming after more of those jobs, but then there's the protectionism that a number of countries, particularly China, pursue, so that they can achieve technological innovation without having to endure competition. But other countries endure competition because it's viewed as something that enhances their own productivity. But eventually, when one is, I think, protected from competition and gets a chance to copy what everyone else is doing, and then to enhance the ideas, the original ideas that others come up with, well, then it does become a rather challenging environment. And then when that can be blamed for the loss of living standards, then we come into a difficult environment. And I think that is the direction that we're coming in. But the Chinese market has been going sideways now for most of this year, and it is now firming from the region of the trend mean. So, a steadier environment in China would certainly be positive for the global economy. We're still in an environment where the renminbi is quite strong, and inflationary pressures are rising, but not in a linear fashion, and there are both push and pull factors. Obviously, there's a lot of supply chain problems, and that is creating short-term fears of inflation. But in order to have medium-term inflation, and inflation that trends rather than is popping on the upside in a sporadic manner, well, then we need to have wage growth, and not wage growth on a one-off basis, but wage growth that grows over time. So, a large number of companies are now going to offer $13 to $17 an hour, and then we can think about, well, are those minimum wages going to be $20 an hour in 5 years' time? Because that's what a trend of inflation would look like. And if that's what we have, well, then there would be a rationale for thinking that, yes, we are now in more of an inflationary environment, and that the supply bottlenecks are intransigent in nature, and that they're not going to simply get fixed within the next year or two. But that is the basis upon which we would have to conclude that inflationary pressures are rising. The other way of thinking about it is that inflation might not be trending in a clear manner, but the supply of money is. And gold prices have been recovering over the course of the last 3 months. Now they're due some consolidation, and we can think about the consistency of the little ranges that we've had. There was one at the beginning of April, another at the end, and then another in May. And now, if we get a little pullback in the order of $50 and support in the region of the trend mean, well, then that would continue to look like a very consistent short-term trend. On the other hand, if gold starts to pull back in a more violent manner, well, then that would be a we would then be looking for it to find support above $1,700. It needs to put in a higher reaction low in order to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. And if it firms from the region of the trend mean, that could possibly be the most benign environment overall. It's also worth keeping an eye on what silver does, because it does tend to act in a high beta fashion relative to gold, and it's right in the region of the upper side of this range that's been forming since August. So if silver can break on the upside, well then a gold is probably not going to take all that long to do so as well. When we then think about some of the other supply bottlenecks that are out there, well, the Baltic Dry Index has completed its base formation. So there's certainly a shortage of ships, and it's looking like we're getting now the beginning of the first step above the base. And if we get that, well, then there's clear scope that we're going to see significantly higher shipping prices overall. With the continued rebound in energy overall, well, that is starting to create greater demand for uranium. And when we think, and I did have the correct ticker. The GlobalX Uranium ETF has been trending higher now for most of this year. It's been a little bit softer over the last week, but certainly the dynamics are on the upside, and it's really only in the foothills of beginning to recover. So there's certainly a lot more interest in the commodity complex overall. There's certainly the potential that the supply bottlenecks are not easily going to be solved, and not until prices at least are significantly higher than they are already. And the semiconductors index is where one of the most acute one of the or at least the well most well-publicized supply bottlenecks exist, and that does act as a tailwind overall, even though the outsized demand for semiconductors in 2020 is unlikely to be repeated. The continued upward trend of demand from the automotive sector in particular is likely to suspend, or I guess to hold up the prices that we have right now. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.